Chapter 30, Karmic Patterns. I have made occasional references in these pages to the karmic threads or patterns of coincidence that run through human life. Those patterns can be discerned not only in the lives of individuals, but in the vast tapestry of history with its panorama of nations, cultures, and religions. History, as has been many times said, repeats itself, and many of its repetitions demonstrate moral and spiritual principles. They may be seen in the eventual destruction of persons or nations that seek to destroy others. They may be seen also in a continuity of regional and national characteristics. The Germanic people, for example, have always shown exceptional ability in many fields. Julius Caesar noted it more than 2,000 years ago. He noted also that, as a consequence, they repeatedly rose to prominence, only to fall again because of excessive conceit. Another example may be seen in the artistic talent of the ancient Etruscans. Their gift continued into the story of Florence and Tuscany, giving birth eventually to the European Renaissance. One thinks, too, of the American Indians, independent yet cooperative within their own nations and dedicated to living in harmony with nature. Their consciousness must have impregnated the North American soil, for the white settlers also absorbed much of it. It was manifested in the pioneer settlers of the West, in their ability to cooperate with one another. The independent spirit of Americans is well known, and the growing interest of their descendants in harmony between man and nature suggests that Americans today may not only have absorbed that consciousness from another people, but in many cases may actually be those people reincarnated. Many of them today, at any rate, express a deep affinity for the earlier Indian culture. I have noticed this phenomenon also in New Zealand and Australia, a tendency to express in new ways many aspects of the culture they thought they'd supplanted. I don't propose here, however, to examine those similarities in detail. Suffice it to say that this was the impression I formed on my visits there. As for Ananda, I have often thought that the community movement, difficult as it has been to get started, would have been far more difficult to launch in any other country. The openness of present-day Americans to new ideas made it easier, finally, for Paramhansa Yogananda to start a mission designed to bring harmony and a sense of common purpose to the world's great religions. Not for nothing is America called the New World. Its very newness puts it in a position to accept more easily a teaching intended to lift all humanity into a new age. Perhaps with the new age insights that are now sweeping the world, it will be possible to break some of the fixed karmic patterns of the past. Yogananda declared, "I was sent by God and the Masters to bring back original Christianity, as taught by Jesus Christ, and the original yoga teachings of Krishna as taught in the Bhagavad Gita." End quote. Truth never changes, but its manifestations are at the same time ever new. The Bible tells us that nothing new exists under the sun, but there is repeated rediscovery. Christopher Columbus, as people are generally aware now, was by no means the first person from the so-called outer world to discover America. With America's rediscovery, however, there came an opportunity for reappraisal, for reaffirmation of what was true, and rejection of what was false. The karmic patterns that concern us here are those running through the fabric of Christian history specifically. Yogananda made it clear that Jesus, in his original teachings, placed little emphasis on outer religion, that is to say, on church affiliation and church rituals. Had Jesus intended to strengthen people in their outer affiliation, he would have tried to work with the rabbis of his times. Instead, he challenged them outspokenly. He stated that he'd been sent to fulfill the law and the prophets. But clearly that fulfillment didn't embrace the rabbinical point of view. He could not have intended to fulfill the law and the prophets in an outward, institutional way, only to contradict himself by urging his followers to establish a separate church. The fulfillment of which he spoke was the deeper teachings of the prophets, the teaching of self-realization, the inner ritual of communion with God in deep meditation. Paramhansa Yogananda, befitting his own mission to, quote, bring back original Christianity, named his organization Self-Realization Fellowship. He declared that SRF wasn't a new sect. Its purpose was only to give renewed emphasis to an important universal principle. To him, this name signified self-realization for every soul through communion with God, inner fellowship or satsanga with great saints and masters, and outward fellowship with truth-seeking souls. With the obvious purpose of establishing a new karmic pattern, he sought to prevent a reenactment of what he considered the disaster in Christian history by founding an organization dedicated specifically, even by name, to perpetuating these high ideals. The ancient karmic patterns, however, were already established and powerful. Self-realization fellowship, in its short history to date, has already introduced many changes into his work. The founding ideals of the organization were clearly stated by Yogananda in its name, in his aims and ideals, some of which, however, have already been changed, in his books, in countless lectures. His organization unfortunately found itself drawn by the old karma into the vortex of churchianity. By an irony of fate, the four principal directors, loyal disciples all, Tara, Daya, Ananda, and Mrinalini, were also former Mormons, raised in a tradition of absolute obedience to a supreme bishop, whose dominance is quite as absolute as the Pope's is in Rome. Does this mean that nothing can be done now to return Yogananda's work to the spirit of individual freedom he intended? I understand from certain knowledgeable people that Yogananda grieved over these matters in letters to his closest disciple, Rajarshi Janakananda. He warned Dayamata, "How you all will change this work." Perhaps he even hinted to me of the need for fresh blood when he said, "You have a great work to do, Walter." Perhaps those words contained a subtle plea, for he said to me also in May of 1950 at 29 Palms, "Apart from St. Lynn or Rajarshi, every man has disappointed me, and you mustn't disappoint me." He certainly didn't mean that all had disappointed him as disciples. We were talking then of the future of his work. His disappointment was that, whereas the spread of the work demanded more of an outgoing masculine energy, no male disciple so far, except for Rajarshi, had understood the broad implications of his mission. I myself, before I was dismissed from SRF, was the only man on a 9-person board of directors. To Dr. Lewis, he said, "No matter what you or I do, this work, that is to say, this mission, will follow a certain pattern ordained by God." What can those words signify except a reference to karmic patterns? For Master would never have set his will against God's will, and certainly he hoped that no true disciple would ever do so either. God had sent him into this incarnation to change old karmic patterns, to reinforce the bright threads, if possible, and diminish or eliminate the dark ones. It must be understood, of course, that no one, however great, could change the whole tapestry. God himself would never do that, for it would mean going against his own karmic law. God never treats human beings as puppets, making and remaking history without reference to their individual and national karmas. When Yogananda used the words ordained by God, what he meant was ordained by the karmic law established by God. Again, if Yogananda was sent to bring back original Christianity, and if he saw that karmic currents would actively oppose that divine purpose, he did not mean that those currents would win out, quite the opposite. In one way or another, by one instrument or another, the purpose of his incarnation, divinely ordained, cannot fail. For this is, as I said, a new age, declared to be such by our own gurus. It is an age of energy. Jesus came at a time of descent into materialism and the entrenchment of people's consciousness in solid forms and fixed dogmas. In the present age, albeit materialistic, people's consciousness of matter itself is the underlying reality of energy. Human understanding is lighter now, more expansive, less inclined to lock everything into fixed definitions and forms. I have often told Ananda members, if by any chance we fail in carrying out the divine plan, God will find others to do so. If Master gave me a work to fulfill, it was not to me personally. This is simply a mission that needs fulfilling. The advantage to our fulfilling it is that I knew him personally. I can recall countless examples from his life that support what we are doing. And if anyone here, or if I myself, feel inclined to make a wrong choice, I can recall too many examples as possible correctives, and will always do my sincere best to abide by those examples." End quote. Paramahansa Yogananda often remarked, "Jesus Christ was crucified once, but his teachings have been crucified daily for nearly 2,000 years." End quote. In making this statement, he implied not another failure, but eventual triumph. As he himself sometimes said, "The spirit I like in America is implied in the saying, eventually, eventually, why not now?" We live in a new age, an age of energy. Humanity is ready to embrace a new and broader understanding. As Yogananda predicted, self-realization will someday become the religion of the world. I challenged Dayamata on this point in 1990 at a meeting between SRF and Ananda in Fresno. I said, "Master cannot possibly have meant Self-Realization Fellowship Incorporated. He had to have meant self-realization as a principle." Daya replied, "That's your opinion." Daya's way of responding to every challenge has always been to suppress it. "But no, Daya, it is not mere opinion. It is self-evident in Yogananda's mission itself. He predicted that a new understanding would in time become the basis of all religions, a recognition that the purpose of religion is the realization of the one true self of all beings within." The betrayal by Judas has been treated as a unique event in history. It was by no means so. Yogananda even explained that Judas, personally, could have avoided the karmic pattern that forced him to that betrayal. Judas merely perpetuated an already existing karma in Judaism itself, and perhaps in all religions. Jesus referred to this pattern when he declared, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, which killest the prophets, and stonest them that are sent unto thee, How often would I have gathered thy children together, as a hen doth gather her brood under her wings, and ye would not. Luke 13:34. There has been a perpetual struggle in Christianity between inner soul aspiration and egoic desire for power, control, and worldly recognition. Judas betrayed Jesus because of his desire for money and worldly acceptance. The karmic invitation, however, to respond to those delusions was already woven into the tapestry of history. By that betrayal, the thread was woven also into that part of the tapestry which depicts the story of Christianity. Yogananda, in saying that the teachings of Jesus have continued to be betrayed, was speaking from his realization of God. He was not speaking as a historian. His statement was born of divine insight, not of scholarly logic. He also named the betrayer churchianity, distinct, as he pointed out, from Christianity. It is institutionalism that has undermined the purity of Christ's teachings. Judas, by his betrayal of Jesus, only gave another push to the downward spiral of delusion that was present already in Judaism. The churches added a push of their own, like runners, to change the metaphor, seizing the baton in a relay race. One wonders how Judas fell, if, as Yogananda said, he could have avoided this destiny. What he did was open himself to the broader karma of his own people. His first thought, so one imagines, was, "The Master deserves wider recognition. It's a pity to see such a motley array of followers around him. Earnest, no doubt, but hardly voices to which important people will ever listen. His greatness deserves recognition by the real powers in this world." Finding Jesus unreceptive to his idea, Judas must have tried to justify it by dwelling on the importance which those powers centered in themselves. His next step, once he developed that mindset, would naturally have been to concentrate on the source of that power, money. The Bible calls Judas a thief. Surely he was not yet one when Jesus selected him as one of the 12 apostles. One imagines Judas thinking, during his gradual descent into delusion, "If only Jesus weren't so unworldly." Gradually, his focus would have shifted from inner communion with God, which Jesus had taught him, to the value of worldly approval and influence. Every thought form has its own magnetism. The more we invest a thought with energy, the greater its magnetic hold on us. One can be drawn into any delusion by simply concentrating on it and investing it with energy. The satanic force is not some sly, shifty-eyed imp with horns, hooves, and a long tail. Satan, Yogananda explained, is an aspect of infinite consciousness itself. God, in creating the universe, manifested an infinite number of thought forms, each of them itself a vortex of consciousness and energy. Thus, each thought form generates its own magnetism. Satan is that force which consciously draws one into the ideational vortex of one's choice, and prevents him from releasing his awareness and letting it expand toward infinity. Many vortices are generated by human beings themselves, by their infatuation, for example, with collecting trivia such as paperweights or china figurines. The desire to accumulate, on the other hand, is universal. It draws power from infinite consciousness, narrowly focusing it in the ideational vortex of I and mine. As Yogananda put it in Autobiography of a Yogi, thoughts are universally and not individually rooted. Certain of those thought forms resonate particularly with human nature. Thus Judas was tempted, through his fascination with outer importance, into an ideational vortex of money, power, and personal recognition. That vortex had the power to attract him as long as he himself responded to it. Having once entered it, he was sucked downward. When its power of attraction was spent, it spewed him out again as if out of the bottom of the whirlpool. Suddenly he recognized the enormity of the evil he'd perpetrated. Filled with self-loathing, he took his own life. The karma of Christ's crucifixion was not only that single act of betrayal, nor was it expiated by that suicide. The act had been foretold long before the life of Jesus, and the karma persists even to this day. What is the karma? It is that world-involving tendency to take the highest spiritual teaching, the soul's relation to truth and God, and to redefine it in such a way as to control those who believe in it. The Church has consistently kept a tight rein on what it is pleased to call Christian worship. It has persecuted what it calls heretics. It has even persecuted its saints. Thus also did the Jews long before Jesus, for they considered their saints, whom they called prophets, threats to the status quo. While the saints or prophets were alive, they were persecuted. Once they were safely dead, their persecutors claimed credit for their holiness. The Jews would not accept any revelation that was not already declared in their scriptures. A rabbi I met in Jerusalem said, even if the temple of Jerusalem were to descend from heaven onto the place where it once stood, I would consider it my duty to measure it carefully and see whether it corresponded exactly to the measurements given in the scriptures. The Christian Church also has insisted that there could be no revelation since New Testament times, that the final declaration of truth can be found only in the Bible. Thus, the Church avoided the need to deal with any influence that might pulverize its rigid theology. The Jews, of course, have refused to accept Jesus even as a prophet, for Judaic theology was already ossified by New Testament times. Had there been openness in the time of Jesus, there would never have been a Christian religion. Jesus himself never said he'd been sent to start a new religion. Rather, what he told people was, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am come not to destroy, but to fulfill." Matthew 5:17. The first Christian, as has been well said, was not Jesus Christ, but St. Paul. It is unfortunately common in this world for tradition to be built up like a stone wall to enclose its tenets, saying, "This much we accept and no more." That was what Yogananda meant in saying that the teachings of Jesus Christ have been crucified daily. The spirit of Judas lives on, vitalized by the churches themselves. Interestingly, Yogananda himself was aware of and even valued both sides of this issue. He was not anti-authoritarian, as one might expect from the fact that he prized inner freedom so highly. He only wanted people to give supreme recognition to divine, not merely to church authority. He showed this orthodox outlook in the way he summed up an episode that he and others of us witnessed together in an Indian movie called The Light of India, about the life of Gyandev, a medieval Indian saint. Gyandev is perhaps better known in India as Gyaneshwar. Gyandev's father had been born a Brahmin. He sinned, however, against the Brahminical code and as a result was declared an outcast. Later in life, he paid the supreme penalty for his sin by committing suicide. The Brahmins of his day, however, would not reinstate his children as Brahmins even then, for they could find no sanction for doing so in the scriptures. Gandev reminded them that the Bhagavad Gita states that all beings are equal in the sight of God. Thereupon the priests replied, "On this particular point, the scriptures are silent. Therefore, we must be silent also." Receiving this answer, Gandev started to recite a passage from the Bhagavad Gita, which declares that God is equally manifested in all beings. A priest placed a hand over his mouth, trying to stop him from speaking. At that moment, a bull standing nearby finished the passage, speaking in a deep bovine tone. The Brahmins then had to accept Gandev as a great soul indeed, and reinstated all of them, humbly stating, "Truly, it is you who are the true Brahmins." Yogananda's comment afterwards was, "Those priests were right also, however, to abide by the scriptures as they understood them. Gandev was right, but they too were right. What Gandev did was simply give them a higher perception of truth." Thus, Yogananda's statement that the churches have crucified the teachings of Christ by churchifying them cannot mean that he faulted them for acting according to their sincere understanding. What he faulted only was their narrow vision and their determination to impose their narrowness on others. In India, this danger is avoided by the general recognition that true saints revitalize religion and bring to priestly understanding the fresh air of direct inner realization.